It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with a Spanish professor at Lawrence University in Appleton. Rosa Tapia begins a four-year term as the national leader in the evaluation of the College Board's Advanced Placement Spanish exam, overseeing scoring of Spanish language proficiency for hundreds of thousands of high school seniors who take this AP exam. You can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, sharing comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Rosa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So as a leader of the College Board's AP Spanish program, how well do AP courses in high school translate to college-level education?
From my perspective as a professor, they translate very well. The exam that I oversee is equivalent to an intermediate level college course in Spanish, just to give you that example that I know very well. And so when students get credit through their score in the AP exam, we know exactly where to place them. We know exactly what credit to give them. And we know exactly what they can do in the classroom. So we can tailor our own courses to match and meet them where they already are.
Can you give us a glimpse inside your world? Like, what is the job of the chief reader in the AP Spanish exam?
Well, the main responsibility is to oversee the scoring, the evaluation of those hundreds of thousands of exams that you talked about. So that involves working with a large team of like almost 1,500 educators from high school and college from across the country, from over 1,000 institutions, and get them to score as a single person and to, you know, do the training and make it all happen over the course of 1 week to make sure that all students get their fair score and their chance to get the credit they need for college.
How do you ensure the consistency that the fair and valid scoring, you know, when there are hundreds of AP readers scoring the exam?
It's a challenging process, but it's very well thought out and very detailed. And it includes a pretty prolonged training and aspect to make sure that our evaluators feel well prepared to do their job.
Is there ever debate over what should be in the exam?
Always, you know, with teachers, we love to debate. So there's obviously thousands of educators teaching the course across the country. So they have input in terms of what goes into the course. And there's a team of educators developing the course itself, as well as the exam. So there's always debate behind what should be in it, how it should evolve to make sure that we are up to date with what, you know, our expectations are of students, in this case, in the study of Spanish language and its cultures.
I wonder, too, if there is debate over how do you know when a question is scorable and it's something that is clear for the student taking the test?
We can't imagine. I think you can't imagine how long, you know, those debates are. We do dwell on those topics. We make sure that all voices are included. It's an inclusive process here to make sure that we hear from a variety of teachers from a variety of backgrounds, as well as schools, to make sure that those questions are well designed so that they are fair and they can measure what they want to measure of students' abilities.
So stepping back into the world we live in, the census estimates roughly 5% of Wisconsin residents speak Spanish at home. How do you develop an AP Spanish program that caters to native and non-native speakers?
In my opinion, you hit it on the nail. That's one of the most challenging and beautiful parts of this exam. As you know, Spanish is the second language of communication and business in the U.S. with more than 50 million speakers in the country. So that means that more than half of the test takers of this exam have a personal or family connection to the language. Mm. So the challenge here is to design an exam that is fair for them and also for students who are taking Spanish only in school as a second language. So the course is an interdisciplinary course in which students study topics related to family and communities, personal and public identities, beauty and aesthetics, science and technology, contemporary life, and global challenges. So as you can see, a very interdisciplinary curriculum that is studied in the context of Spanish cultures outside of the U.S. and in the U.S. in a way that is appealing to both speakers of Spanish, who practice the language or get to hear it at home, as well as those who only get to experience it in the classroom. So we want to make sure that the exam captures their experience in the course as well.
Seems like a very holistic approach. Rosa Tapia with a Spanish professor at Lawrence University and leader of the College Board's AP Spanish program for your term is now underway. You can join in the conversation at any point with your question, your comments at 800-642-1234. Rosa, there are reports that Chippewa County and other western parts of the state, they struggle to provide in-person interpreters for court hearings. How big is the need in Wisconsin for Spanish interpreters?
That's not my field of expertise. I often act as the intermediary between the services, that provide interpreters who are recruiting college students because the need is so high. So that's my only experience of this issue. So that, because of the types of requests that I get a sense that it's high, but I'm not knowledgeable enough to be able to speak to the issue.
Perhaps looking at it this way, though, does learning Spanish open up job opportunities for your students?
Oh, for sure. I can't speak to that. In fact, a lot of our graduates who either major or minor in Spanish or even just take, a few courses in Spanish, reach out later in life. They get back to us and say that, it was Spanish what got me my first job or, foot in the door. Like I said, with Spanish being the second language of communication and business, that's not surprising.
What do AP exams in Spanish open up for students? What do they enable them to do, for the rising college student?
Well, AP exams in general are a great incentive just to apply to college, which is a huge thing in itself. So there's research that shows that students who take from like 1 to 2 AP courses have higher graduation rates in college, and their performance is better during their first year in college. And there's data to support this. So this can also have a financial impact because, it'll be lowering their overall debt. So what we know is that students perform, first of all, they are encouraged to go to college. They perform better while they're there, and they graduate on time, more so than students who don't take AP classes. So that's one of the incentives for us educators to become involved with the program.
How can students practice Spanish outside the classroom? What do you suggest to your students?
So many ways nowadays. students ask me all the time. So I always get back to them with the question, so what do you do for fun? What do you read for fun? What do you listen for fun in terms of music or podcasts or what do you watch for fun? And when they tell me, I'm like, well, you can do the same, but in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So there's so much entertainment, so many materials nowadays that are accessible, widely accessible for everyone. So it's just a matter of finding that time to do what you like to do for fun. It's just by, committing to doing it in that other language that you want to practice.
I wonder, what is your take on apps like Duolingo and are students on their phones to learn a language?
I think they're a great way to get started with the language. I've used them myself for French, for example, to just review some basic concepts. So I think that as you are starting to become acquainted with the language, they're a great resource because you can do it at any point during your day. As your knowledge of the language gets more advanced, it's probably not enough. At that point, you probably need some kind of formal instruction or make sure that you have those opportunities to practice with actual people, right? Because learning a language is a social activity.
you know, part of your 4-year term involves, as I understand it, mentoring the next chief reader, mentoring the person who will replace you. How do you approach that? What will be your words of advice to mentoring someone to be the chief reader?
The process of selecting the next chief reader, it's a multi-year process. Hmm. So usually you select someone who's already part of your team. So someone who's already a question leader or an exam leader or someone who already holds a position of responsibility in the process and knows parts of it. And essentially you can get a slate of possible candidates at the end. And there's a team of people from the educational testing services side of things and the College Board side of things who select the final candidate who gets to shadow the current chief reader for a year and gets to see all the different parts of the process going from selecting and applicants who want to become AP readers to sitting in the development committee that develops the exam, as well as overseeing all of the different parts of the reading, which involves, you know, all the logistical aspects of it, like, of, you know, what do we need materially? How many people do we need it? And how do we get it done?
Rosa, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rosa Tapia is a Spanish professor at Lawrence University in Appleton, leader of the College Board's AP Spanish program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Opioid manufacturers and distributors are paying more than $50 billion to settle lawsuits over the toll of opioids. Our state Justice Department estimates Wisconsin's share tops $700 million. KFF Health News is tracking how states and local governments use the settlement money. And you can call in with a question or share comments at any time, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Aneri Patani is senior correspondent for KFF Health News, a journalist in residence at UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. Aneri, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
The settlement money comes from companies that made or distributed these prescription painkillers. How does Wisconsin's share of fund settlements compare to other states?
So Wisconsin, as you mentioned, is getting over $700 million across settlements with various companies. And honestly, that number is going up because several settlements are done and agreed to, but others are still in the works. So, you know, there was a national settlement with Kroger, which is a grocery and pharmacy chain, done recently. There are others that are still in the works. So it's likely that number is going to go up, as it is for all the states that participate. So I think there's a lot of money on the way, and it's going to be seen how that's used.
And states like Wisconsin have this like one chance to get this allocation of hundreds of millions of dollars right. How does this settlement compare to the impact of the tobacco settlement in the 90s?
I think the tobacco settlement looms large over this one because back then in the 90s, states sued a lot of the cigarette companies and got, you know, billions of dollars that in theory were to be used to address the problems of smoking, to essentially stop people from starting or help people quit who had already started smoking. But what ended up happening with that money is that a lot of it went to plug state budget gaps, especially during 2008 when the recession hit. Folks used it to just shore up the budget. Other places used it for corporate tax breaks. In some parts of the country, North and South Carolina actually used it to subsidize tobacco farmers. So the money was used for a lot of things that had nothing to do with stopping smoking. So when these opioid settlements were coming up, people said, we don't want that to happen again. So a lot of the settlements have a particular stipulation that says at least 85% of the money has to be used for opioid-related purposes. Now, there's still wiggle room within that, but the idea is that this is money to address the opioid epidemic, which is ongoing, which is, in the last year, we had more than 100,000 people across the country die of drug overdoses. So the idea is this money should be used in ways that brings that number down and that tackles the crisis.
As you talk about these potential pitfalls with the settlement money, like using it to plug holes in a budget or to repay debts, how do you develop a state? How does Wisconsin like develop a fair and transparent process for deciding where to spend the funding?
So in Wisconsin, the money is divided between local and state government, which is true of most states. Most states have some portion going to sort of counties and cities for them to control, and some portion for a state government to control. In Wisconsin, 30% of all the settlement funds are controlled by the Department of Health Services. And they have been pretty transparent. They have a website where they list their annual spending plans. They have to submit their plan for the money to the Joint Committee on Finance in the legislature, and they have been putting out quarterly reports that explain where the money went. But then you have the other 70% of the funds that are controlled by county governments and local governments. And there's a requirement that local governments keep their settlement funds in sort of a separate account and don't just throw it into the general fund so that it is used separately and appropriately. But there's not a lot of public reporting requirements. The local governments have to tell the Department of Justice how it uses the money, but it's not necessarily required that that becomes public. And so the bulk of the money, which sits with local governments, might be really hard for members of the public to track and understand where it's being used, how it's being used, if it's being used appropriately.
So there is less visibility at the local government level for how the 70% is potentially going to be used. And the state's 30% has some more transparency for how where that money is going. Who decides? Who in Wisconsin gets to decide how the money is spent?
So it depends on the buckets of who's controlling it. The bucket, that 30% bucket that sits with the state, the Department of Health Services creates a plan and then it goes to the legislature and the legislature has to approve it or change it, which they've done a few times. And that's sort of the final decision on the money. The 70% that is controlled by local governments, that will vary from county to county. So it's a lot of times it's county commissioners. Sometimes county commissioners will say, hey, we give the bulk of the money to our county health department and they get to decide. It really is a patchwork. And this is reflective of the entire country where figuring out who controls this money changes at every state level, at every county level, at every city level. And so it is very difficult for the public to track the money because for every place you're interested in, you have to learn their process, which might differ from the place next door.
We're discussing about the decisions for spending opioid settlement funds. Aneri Patani, senior correspondent for KFF Health News. You can join the conversation calling in with a question, sharing your insights at 800-642-1234. Aneri, how are these funds intended to be used? What are you seeing that states are using it on, or have they not even started to use it yet?
Different states are in different phases of the process. Many states have started using the funds. Wisconsin is among them, at least at the state level where there is that reporting. We can see, they have used money for buying naloxone, which is the medication that reverses an opioid overdose, and fentanyl test strips. They've used it to help fund medications that treat opioid use disorder. These are things like buprenorphine, known as Suboxone or methadone. They've used it to cover like room and board for people who are looking to get residential treatment. And that I think is reflective of a lot of other states as well. Many states are putting money towards treatment, whether that is particular medications or residential treatment. They are also putting money towards naloxone, and getting that into the hands of people who use drugs or getting it into the hands of law enforcement who respond to overdoses. We are also seeing a lot of places use money to support law enforcement agencies, and that can mean a lot of things. There are some places that are buying cruisers for their, police officers or sheriff's departments. Some are buying surveillance equipment, technology that unlocks cell phones, kind of focusing on the part of, disrupting drug trafficking. And we've seen that in Wisconsin as well, where the Department of Health Services had an initial plan for the using the money, and when it went to the legislature, they sort of cut some of the money that was intended for family support programs and prevention services, and instead reallocated $3 million for county sheriff's departments.
I wonder, do you see states focusing at all on racial equity as they look to spend this money?
Not across the board, at least explicitly. I think some places are being thoughtful about that and calling it out in their meetings and sort of saying we need to address this, particularly because nationwide overdose death rates are climbing especially fast among Native American and Black American populations. But I think in a lot of places it also isn't so much on the radar of the folks who are making these spending decisions. Wisconsin is doing using a lot of its money to support tribal nations. I think they've put over $6 million towards that so far. So I think it's something that's being considered here.
In August, the Supreme Court blocked Purdue Pharma, the Sackler family, from proceeding with a bankruptcy settlement that would have shielded the family from future civil litigation from the opioid epidemic. What are you watching for in this case and how it would affect settlements with states like Wisconsin?
Yeah, this case is really interesting, and it's been going on such a long time. I think the big question we're watching to see is the Department of Justice halted this settlement and basically said the Sackler family can't use bankruptcy as a way to get personal immunity. So if it moves forward, the Supreme Court could agree with the department and say, hey, this deal is off because bankruptcy is not an appropriate way to get individual immunity for members of the family. And then perhaps they would have to agree to a new deal, or we don't exactly know what would happen if that was the case. Or the Supreme Court could say, no, it's fine, the deal as it was struck, in which case the family members would not be persecuted, not have to pay out themselves, but the company would pay $6 billion out of its bankruptcy as part of these settlements.
We'll be watching
What I
for
will say,
that.
though,
Yeah. I
oh,
just
it's
want
just
to.
that settlement is not a huge one compared to a lot of the other companies are already paying. So that's a smaller amount of money compared to $26 billion has already been paid by others.
We have a limited time here. I want to jump in. Jean from Dane County called, lost a daughter to opioid overdose. And Jean's daughter always wanted to have childcare available during treatment. Can the money be spent in this way to provide that type of service?
Yeah, I think that would definitely fall under the allowable uses. There's a list put on with appended to the end of the settlements that sort of says, support it, and it on that list includes supporting pregnant or parenting people who are dealing with opioid use disorder.
Aneri, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Aneri Patani is a senior correspondent at KFF Health News, a journalist in residence at UW-Madison's Center for Journalism Ethics. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.